This is tape number one, the afternoon of January the 6th, 1961. The President, Noyes, Hillman, present.
Now, Mr. President, we were just getting around to tragedy of the assassination of President Lincoln and his accession by Johnson, and the tragic events that occurred in the nation as a result of that assassination. Could you describe what happened there?
Well, the situation was one of the most delicate with which this republic's been faced. And the objective of Lincoln, I think, was to rehabilitate the South, just as we tried to rehabilitate the countries after the First and Second World Wars. But he met with severe opposition in the Congress due to the fact that the Congress was led by an old man who was bitterly involved in a hatred program against all the Southern setup. He wanted to make them a conquered country. And that old man will go down in history as one of the worst leaders that the House of Representatives ever had in its history, on account of his attitude toward all sorts of compromises that were necessary to be made in order to get the job done in the way it should have been done after the war between the states was over.
Now, he was known as the leader of the Radical Republicans. Now, what made them radical? Why were they called the Radical Republicans?
They were called the Radicals because they wanted to treat the South as conquered territory. And that made them the Radical Republicans. Although they had been radical before that, during Lincoln's administration, but he managed to outmaneuver them in most of the cases where they could do any serious harm. Although the Committee on the Conduct of the War was made up of a joint committee of the House and the Senate, and it caused Lincoln more embarrassment than the loss of all the battles that all the generals lost. That committee was worth two divisions to the South, as General Lee said in his memoirs.
Now, when they were called radicals, they were not, they didn't mean radicals in the sense that we mean it now.
No, they were radical in the settlement of the aftermath of the war.
Yet they were in the forefront of those who fought for the emancipation of the Negro.
Some of them were, a lot of them were not.
This was not necessarily
didn't have a thing in the world to do with it. They wanted to treat the South as conquered territory because they wanted to keep the Radical Republicans in control of the Congress of the United States, and they were very much afraid that if the South was allowed to elect its senators and representatives, they would no longer be in control. That's really what was behind it.
Now, they were
a matter of control of the political organization of the government of the United States.
Now, this again, then, is a case where the Congress rebelled against a strong president when they got a weak one in Johnson. Or was Johnson a weak president?
Johnson wasn't a weak one, but Johnson was in a very embarrassing position, you see. He was a Union Democrat. His home was in Tennessee. He'd been governor of Tennessee, and he'd had been United States senator from Tennessee. But he was against secession. And of course, when the National Union Party met in Baltimore and nominated Lincoln again for the presidency, Lincoln, instead of taking Hannibal Hamblin, who had been his vice president in the first administration, thought he ought to have a Union Democrat from the South, and he took Andrew Johnson. An old, the old guy we're talking about was
Stevens.
Thaddeus Stevens. An Andy Mason, a know-nothing, and finally a Republican. And the new Republican Party came along. And he was bitter against Southern Democrats, whether they were loyal or not. And that was what brought about all this situation. But he happened to be the leader of the House of Representatives, turned out to be a strong leader, and he succeeded in discrediting Andrew Johnson. But in doing that, he discredited himself. And history now is beginning to tell just exactly what he was. Now I've got an essay on his background and his actions that's one of the best I've ever seen. Of course, I'm a little prejudiced against the old devil because he wasn't any good.
Well, now, Johnson was hamstrung by Stevens in that they, first of all, took away the administration of the South from the executive, and then they also took away the power to dismiss any member of the cabinet.
What is the name of that bill?
Stanton? Oh, I see.
What is the name of the bill that had to do with the Congress, which the Congress passed that prevented the president from firing anybody he had appointed to the office. It was finally declared unconstitutional because he didn't have the right to do it.
We'll check on the name.
Well,
I'll get the name of that bill in a minute. It was it's just a simple name of the piece of legislation that was to deprive the president of his powers as an executive. And that's been attempted by nearly every Congress where there's a strong president.
They fired Stanton and put General Grant in his place, and then Congress declared that action illegal, and he had to put Stanton back in as...
I don't know whether that was
the war
or not, but then he finally put General Grant in as Secretary of War. And
Grant quit.
And Grant wouldn't obey orders. He didn't obey the orders of the president. He's commander-in-chief. And it was just as rotten as it possibly could be. I don't think he fired Stanton. I think he moved Stanton around somewhere or another, because that bill was then passed, which prevented the president from firing his own cabinet.
Well, he was a radical Republican, Stanton was, and he was out of sympathy with the president.
He was everything. He was whatever was in.
I see.
If you read an outline of his history, you will find that he was for whatever he thought would help Stanton. He didn't give a damn about principle at all.
Well,
too bad they had a cabinet like that Johnson had to inherit, but that's the way they were.
Well, it was a cabinet.
There's only one man in the cabinet, and that was the Secretary of the Navy. The old man with the whiskers. I'll tell you his name in a minute. He's the Wells, Gideon Wells.
Gideon Wells.
Was the only really honest man in that cabinet.
And you question the integrity of every all the rest of them?
Gideon Wells' diary tells the character of every single man in that cabinet, and it's worth reading.
What about Seward? Does he?
Well, question? Seward stayed put. He stayed put. After Lincoln gave him his lesson that he was not the president, he became really a man. The second he became really a man, I'm going to stay in terms of the cabinet.
Presidency was pretty well established as the proper successor to the president without any reduction in.
I'll say that's one thing old John Tyler did. When Daniel Webster won't make him acting president, he says, "I'm the president of the United States. You read the Constitution, you'll find it out."
Now,
he established the president. He was the first one who inherited the office.
And it was Seward who tried the notion on, was it on Lincoln, that the Secretary of State was to act as chairman of the Senate, of the chairman of the cabinet?
Of the cabinet and make policy. And Lincoln let him know very, very briefly that the president of the United States made policy when he offered the Emancipation Proclamation. They all voted no, and he said the ayes have it, there's one aye and the rest are no. And that's how the thing came about. But Seward very soon found that Lincoln was going to be president of the United States and not the Secretary of State.
Now, then Lincoln was the second man in the presidency who utilized the full constitutional scope of the presidency.
Oh, yes, that's on account of the war that he did that. Well, James K. Polk did, too. James K. Polk did the same thing in the Mexican War. He took charge of things and ran the war as the commander-in-chief.
So, Lincoln, in that sense, was not the first president to introduce the idea into our government.
No.
In an emergency, a president had practically no limitation as to the amount of power he could manifest in the interest of the Republic.
For the saving of the Union, he could do it. He can follow through on anything that's necessary to save it. And Polk had done that as commander-in-chief of the Mexican War. He had trouble with old Fuss and Feathers and also with Taylor, Zachary Taylor. And both of them were candidates for president. Well, Fuss and Feathers never got his ambition accomplished, but Taylor did. He was elected president of the United States.
Well, then, in a sense, Lincoln did something that no other president had done before or since. He worked without a Congress, he worked without a Supreme Court, and he worked without generals, as a matter of fact.
Well, he had to fire five generals before he got one to run the war for him.
But it wasn't as sweeping as all that, was it?
No.
Probably did have to work with all three presidents.
He got things out of those hostile, let's say. He worked with a hostile Congress.
Yes.
He worked with a hostile court. And he worked with a hostile cabinet most of the time, but he managed to get around them. Smooth things over so he could get things done that were absolutely essential. And he saved the Union, that's the main thing.
Now, when you say that, you practically say everything that needs to be said about Lincoln.
That's correct. That's all there is to be said about
it. There are no other reforms, no other major reconstructions or changes in our conduct of government or our economy or anything else?
No, he was followed by an outfit that went backward in these laws that they passed to take the powers away from the president, which when they finally reached the Supreme Court were declared unconstitutional.
Now, when Johnson stayed there long enough to prove that he was not quite up to the job of the presidency.
I think he would have been up to it if he'd had favorable cabinet and the support of part of the Congress. I think he would have made a good president. He had plenty of nerve, and he knew what he wanted to do, and he was willing to make decisions. And you find in the late biographies of Johnson that he had a great many qualities that were essential for a president. You must remember that he had a hostile cabinet, he had a hostile Congress, and he had the press almost unanimously against him because he came from the South. But he came back. He made them like it. He went back to Tennessee and ran three times for the Senate and finally got elected. And the last speech he made was a humdinger in on the floor of the Senate. And then he went home and died that same year.
His critics, his enemies, accused him of being impetuous because of drinking a good deal.
He didn't drink any more than the ordinary fellow in the White House always does. He was in a very serious condition physically when he was inaugurated, and he drank some brandy and that sort of thing that found the situation on. He wasn't a drunkard at all.
Actually, Lincoln didn't either drink or smoke, did he?
I don't know. I never believed that. Yeah, I imagine he used some of his product. I'm not sure.
They say he didn't like the stuff.
Well, that's all right. It's a very good thing when a fellow doesn't like it.
Well, you don't like it either.
No, I don't.
The one thing about Johnson that they make a great deal of is that he had very little education, very little training.
He
for
was
the
best informed man on the Constitution of the United States that's ever been in the White House, and he informed himself. His wife contributed to his education, and he was just like Lincoln. He was a vociferous reader. Or that's not the word. You mean what I know?
Avid reader.
An avid reader. That's the word I want. He studied the government and the Constitution of the United States like no other man did before or since. And on the Constitution itself, there wasn't a man in the Congress or in the presidency who had the knowledge of the Constitution and what it provides that Andrew Johnson did.
Do you happen to recall how Lincoln happened to pick him for the second spot?
Yes.
Just explain.
He was called. He was invited to be the vice president because he was a loyal Southern Democrat.
But nothing else, no other distinctions.
Well, he'd been United States Senator from Tennessee, he'd been governor of Tennessee, and he'd been military governor of Tennessee. Lincoln appointed him as military governor of Tennessee, and that's the reason for it.
This is the end of tape number one, the afternoon of January 6, 1961. This is tape two, the afternoon of January 6, 1961.
Well, now, having laid President Johnson to rest, can we go on to his successor,
Ulysses
Samson Grant?
Ulysses? Well, yes, his name was Ulysses. That wasn't his name.
Sylvester or something.
No, his name was...
We
accepted the
name
Ulysses Samson, but his first time he was named by his parents was Ulysses, Hiram Ulysses Grant.
Hiram Ulysses Grant.
He dropped the Hiram and took the word Samson so he could be U.S. for the United States.
He did that deliberately that way.
Yeah.
When did he change that to?
Or while he was going down the Mississippi River, I think, when he was called back into service. He didn't do it as president for. Or his nominee for president. He did long before that. His name was Hiram Ulysses Grant, and his parents named him.
He left pretty much of a mess behind him. What caused that?
Well, the Congress was the cause of the situation, and there was some sort of always has been, some sort of a feeling among professional military men that the obtaining of a lot of money is the most important thing in a man's life. And he had a partner, Branton Ward, who formed an organization on the stock exchange of New York, and not knowing anything about the approach or how the stock exchange worked at that day, which was wide open, had no regulation whatever, it wasn't long until they had everything that Grant and Ward had and a lot more besides, and that's the reason Grant wrote his memoirs. He sold them for $500,000, and I understand that Mark Twain was a great help to him in getting those memoirs ready. And all that money went to help pay the debts of Grant and Ward, which was while he was president of the United States, this was going on.
This was going on while he was president. Now, you made a very important observation there, that military men tend to reach for
They tend to worship wealth, and they like to have it. For what reason, I don't know, but you find that they all feel that way, that the man who's rich is the man they want to cut out to and stay with and associate with.
Would you say that was the strain throughout our experience in terms of wealth?
We only had three professional military men for presidents of the United States. One of them was Zachary Taylor, who was the father-in-law of Jefferson Davis, if you didn't know it, and General Grant, and the man who was just leaving the White House. There are the three professional military men who've been presidents of the United States. And without reflecting on it, about every single one of them was a failure.
How about Harrison? Was he a professional?
No, he wasn't professional. He was a citizen soldier. His home was in Virginia, and he was a very rich man. He had more land in the Northwest Territories than anybody there. Yet he ran on a platform of Tippecanoe and Tyler, too, in which they had a log cabin and cider for the thing on which they
were. Well, would you make it as a flat observation that military men, professional military men, tend to gravitate to wealth?
Yes, that's of course they do, because they usually, in our system, are appointed to West Point by some congressman or senator. They graduate as lieutenants and go on through the military setup, and they become socially conscious. And being socially conscious, they're very anxious to have the wealth to back it up when they retire. You can't blame them for that. It's the system that causes it.
And it also due to the fact that their salaries are pretty meager.
Yes, their salaries and emoluments are not great enough to support the condition to which they think they're entitled. That's one of the reasons for it. But they're not all that way. There have been a great many of them that had no idea in that direction. And I can name two particularly. One of them was Robert E. Lee, and the other one was George C. Marshall.
Coming to George C. Marshall, because you obviously had to exclude him from that group.
Oh, yes, he doesn't belong in that group, and there are dozens of others that don't, but those are the ones that are in the picture, historically, that we can refer to as men who were very much interested in the welfare of the country and not their own personal welfare.
Now, the advent of U.S. Grant as president was, again, one of our low periods in terms of effective government, terms of anything that involved.
Well, it was after the most terrible war that the country had ever suffered, and after any sort of a turmoil like that, there's great difficulty. It's bound to be just as it was after the First World War. Remember, Harding was a result of the First World War and followed a very great president, Woodrow Wilson. And it happens in nearly every instance. It's just happened. Referred to a modern situation.
Not the rule, it just does happen.
It just happens.
Mr. President, before we continue with Grant, I'd like to go back to a figure who seems to be growing in understanding and eminence, who played a great role in history, and that was Robert E. Lee.
That's right.
If it hadn't been for his character, perhaps the end of the Civil War might have been a little bit different. Some conditions which led to the surrender and the aftermath would have been different. Can you? What is your estimate of Robert E. Lee in the American scene?
Well, he was a very, very great military man. I think you'll find him by everyone who has made any survey on the subject, by all experts and historians, that he really was the greatest of our military heroes from a military standpoint. He also was a great leader of men, and he had more to do with the proper settlement of the Southern situation after it was over, because he went back and they had confiscated all the property that he had, which was Arlington, and he had a cemetery out of it, and started to teach school at Washington University, and they changed the name after he died to Washington and Lee University. Had a pittance of a salary. I think all he got was $2,500 a year, president of that college. And he created more character in the young men who went through while he was president of that college than they say there. I was down there not long ago and delivered a lecture that they never had a man who was a character builder equal to Robert E. Lee, and that's the principal thing that makes him great.
What about his feeling as a soldier, as a man who had taken an oath when he became an officer?
Well, there was a situation at that time in which the men who were working for the federal government had the notion that their first loyalty was to the state from which they came. And they all felt that when they resigned their commissions with the government of the United States, that severed their connection and put them back to their state. And you find that most of them did not resign until the state seceded. I know that Lee did not resign until Virginia had seceded. And when they did that, they thought they had severed their connection in an honorable way. I don't agree with them, but then that's what they thought. And we had a president of the United States who had taken the oath as president, who became a Confederate congressman. He was the successor of William Henry Harrison, brother of my great-grandmother's father.
Tyler.
Yeah. John Tyler.
Yeah. Here again we get into the iffy, but it sort of allows you to get some reflection on the scene. What would have happened if Lee hadn't been the chief figure in the Confederacy so far as the military was concerned?
Well, I think the only other two that were under consideration at the time and who stayed in the war until it was over, I think, were Beauregard and Joseph E. Johnson. And I don't think either one of them could accomplish the war in Virginia as Lee did. But the main thing that all the Confederate outfit overlooked was the fact that when Grant split the Confederacy by taking the Mississippi River over by the Federals and the surrender of Vicksburg, had more to do with ending the war than all of the military maneuvers in Virginia. Because the great source of resources outside the country were coming in through New Orleans. And of course that cut Texas and Arkansas and Louisiana all off from the Confederate government. And in 1863 that happened at the same time the Gettysburg Battle was fought. And of course with the surrender of Vicksburg and Gettysburg Battle, that really ended the whole program as far as the effort of the South to win.
What was his relation to Jefferson Davis? What was his regard?
Well, General Lee was a military man who was loyal to the Commander-in-Chief, and Jefferson Davis was the Commander-in-Chief of the Confederate Army, and General Lee treated him as such all the way through.
What is your feeling of Jefferson Davis, Mr.
Well, Jefferson Davis was a graduate of West Point. He'd been Secretary of War in Franklin Pierce's cabinet, and he had been United States Senator from Mississippi three times, I think, inside of two terms. He had the notion that he was a better field commander than anybody he had under him. And all the commanders were disturbed by Jefferson Davis except Lee. Lee knew how to get along with him. He never interfered with Lee. But he did with Joseph E. Johnson. He did with the old man for, what's the name of that camp in North Carolina? That's the name for one of the Confederate generals. Right east of Crawley, where they do a lot of training nowadays. I don't know why I can't see this one. But
we'll look him up.
I'll tell you what his name is in a minute. But he was one of the peculiar ones. We ought to have something to say about him later on. He was adjutant of Fortress Monroe. He was also commander of the troops. And he was also the supply officer. He used to write letters to himself as supply officer, as to himself as adjutant, to himself as commander of the troops, and then replied to him. They made him a lieutenant general in command of the Tennessee Valley.
Okay. was a young fellow, wasn't he?
No. He was Bragg.
Bragg.
Yeah, yeah. Old Taylor. That's a little more great.
Captain Bragg.
That's what it was. Old
well,
Bragg.
Was Jefferson Davis of a stature to be a leader of?
He had, Jefferson Davis had plenty of character. He was really a good man, but he was devoted to details. And instead of telling his generals what he wanted done, let him go ahead and do it. He wanted to know exactly what maneuver they were going to make and how they were going to make it and everything in connection with it. And in the position that he was in, he couldn't do that very well. I've got a characterization of him that's very good, which I'll bring over here.
So he had more or less an involvement with detail that kept him from being the big man he should have been.
That's correct.
Well, did he ever make any statements? Did he ever say anything at all which exalted or inspired the South to go ahead? He wasn't really a leader, was he?
Well, the very fact that he was elected president of the Confederacy at Montgomery, Alabama, when the convention first met to elect a Confederate president, is due to the fact that he was able to make people understand that he had some greatness in him. But one of his great difficulties was the fact that the Southern governors all had an idea that they could secede from the Confederacy whenever they got ready, and they didn't cooperate with it very well. Now, let me bring this characterization of it over. Just found it. It's a good one.
Well, which is raised on either side of the line, trying to bring about some reconciliation or some settlement before a decisive series of battles will have been fought.
No, there wasn't. Because it was felt on both sides that there was no settlement except to win the war.
So it was all or nothing, and there was no attempt made until the struggle was ended.
Until it was ended, until the surrender by Lee.
All right, this is the end of tape number 2 of the afternoon of January 6, 1961.